Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Even if they do approve the funding, are they going to take it away later?
Scientists say the Trump administration's planned cuts would devastate climate research in Alaska. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 25th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, despite a strained relationship with the U.S., Canada's Yukon affirms its ties to Alaska.
We're not going to give a direction to an organization. What we are going to say is just remember how deep and important this relationship is.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. The Trump administration is planning an Alaska summit with leaders of Japan and South Korea in early June. Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports.
Trump's National Energy Dominance Council is planning to discuss the Alaska LNG project with Korean and Japanese officials. That's according to reports from the New York Times and Reuters, each citing unnamed sources familiar with the matter. The White House, the Energy Department, and the Interior Department all declined to confirm the summit in emails to Alaska Public Media. The White House and the Energy Department each emailed identical statements touting the potential benefits of the project and saying the administration was, quote, committed to supporting the Alaska LNG project. The $44 billion 800-mile Arctic Gas Line project would connect North Slope gas fields with a liquefaction facility and export terminal in South Central Alaska. But for decades, the Alaska LNG project has failed to attract enough investors to make it a reality. That's left trillions of cubic feet of natural gas stranded without a market. Since returning to office, though, Trump has repeatedly said the Gas Line project is a priority for his administration. The state agency working towards the Gas Line project signed an agreement last month with developer Glen Farne to bring the project towards a final investment decision. That's expected late this year. Governor Mike Dunleavy traveled to Asia earlier this year to seek foreign investors for the gas line. He returned with a non-binding letter of intent saying Taiwanese state energy company CPC Corporation would purchase gas from the project. But the governor did not return with commitments from enough partners to allow the project to move forward. The ramped-up gas line push comes as countries seek to avoid high tariffs from the Trump administration. The reports from The Times and Reuters say federal officials hope to use the summit to announce commitments from Japan and South Korea to purchase gas from the project. Trade talks with Japan and South Korea are underway, and Japan has floated increasing LNG imports as an element of a potential trade deal. But the Korean industry minister told Reuters he was not aware of any plans to announce a commitment from South Korea. Reporting from Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
The early days of the Trump administration have delivered an economic blow to Canada and shaken its relationship with Alaska. But amid the uncertainty, the state's closest neighbor is affirming the importance of cross-border relationships while also pushing back against Trump's global trade war. Ranj Pillay is the head of the Yukon government and the territory's Minister of Economic Development.
But we also want to make sure that the folks in both Haines and Skagway are reaching out to anybody they can to send the message that this is incredibly damaging.
The last few months have seen a chaotic rollout of Trump's international trade policy. The president has announced and later paused or walked back a range of tariffs on major U.S. trading partners. But some of the policies have stuck, which Pillay says has led to a, quote, absolute desolation of markets. Pillay says it's clear the policies are coming from Washington, D.C., not Alaska or its border towns like Haines or Skagway, and that Alaskan support for Canada has been widely appreciated. That includes testimony from Skagway Assembly members against tariffs at the state legislature. Still, there's a growing movement in Canada to boycott the U.S. in response to the tariffs and Trump's repeated comments about the country becoming the 51st state. Pillay says he's generally avoided trying to advise Canadians on how they should approach doing business in or visiting Alaska.
We're not going to give a direction to an organization. What we are going to say is just remember how deep and important this relationship is.
At a higher level, Canada has responded by imposing some $155 billion in retaliatory tariffs. Alaska could lose several research institutions and a pipeline into science for budding researchers in the state. That's if the Trump administration's proposed cuts to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's budget become a reality. As KTOO's Alex Solomon reports, this translates to a chilling effect on science.
Just the threat of eliminating the agency's budget for climate research is having an effect on scientists in Alaska.
Even the possibility of the disruption is affecting the students and the researchers.
That's Joshua Hosler, a PhD student at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. His research group met this week to discuss if they'd apply for a new federal funding opportunity. And because of the uncertainty, they probably won't.
Even if they do approve the funding, are they going to take it away later?
He says that groups across the university system have been easing up on submitting research proposals for the same reason. Hosler is currently developing a seasonal lightning forecast system to assist wildfire managers in Alaska with planning for the upcoming fire season. But he's funded by a NOAA grant from an office that would be eliminated under the draft cuts. The proposed cuts could slash NOAA's budget by about 27% and eliminate several research organizations funded by the agency in Alaska. The institutions share projects, faculty, and student researchers with the University of Alaska, so the state can understand and adapt to climate change while training the next generation of in-state experts. Hayo Eiken heads the International Arctic Research Center at UAF. He says these NOAA-funded institutes have helped create a pipeline for students to develop research in Alaska and then have opportunities to continue working here after graduating.
These students, in particular the PhD students, they're at the cutting edge of the field. They help us respond much more effectively to various opportunities and challenges that we're facing in Alaska.
One key service that students help with is collecting data at sea. Seth Danielson leads an oceanography lab at UAF. His team tracks ocean conditions, and the data is used to help manage fisheries. NOAA feeds these ocean assessments into a report that the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council uses to set catch limits.
Not all that data is collected only by NOAA. Some of it's collected by university researchers like us.
Most of Danielson's funding comes from NOAA through one of the institutes that would be closed under the proposal. If that happens, he says he would probably have to lay off 4 of his 5 staff members. And he'd lose more than staff. Last August, his team moored $500,000 worth of equipment to the bottom of the ocean. To get the data it's been collecting all year, they need funding to sail out there and retrieve it.
So not only is the data at risk and the students who are relying on that data for their graduate research, but the equipment itself is at risk. The batteries don't last forever.
If the batteries die before Danielson can secure funding for the expedition, all the data would be lost. Here in Juneau, a UAF fisheries lab would have to scale back the number of graduate students and research projects it takes on in the future. Its leader estimates that NOAA pays for at least a third of its research and staff. The proposed cuts come as UAF has set a goal to become one of the top-tier research institutions in the nation. It's called R1 status. To qualify, the university needs to increase the average number of doctorates it awards per year. Laura Connor is vice chancellor for research at UAF. She says that roughly a quarter of the university's operating budget comes from the federal government, and graduate researchers rely on federal dollars.
It's likely that large decreases in federal support could impact R1.
But she says it's hard to predict how it will play out, and UAF is still hopeful it can achieve the status. Even so, she says that a cut to NOAA funding
will have a chilling effect on research across the nation more generally.
Staff at NOAA's Juneau office and the White House declined to comment. Final funding decisions have not yet been made. In Juneau, I'm Alex Solomon.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Thlinget artist blends modern materials with traditional indigenous garments.
Making moccasins really was a way to connect to my family and my ancestors.
That's ahead. Stay with us. The Alaska Department of Corrections has reported 3 in-custody deaths in the month of April so far, bringing the total reported this year to 5 in-custody deaths. The Alaska Beacon reports 49-year-old Nathaniel David Leesk died on April 3rd in the Anchorage Correctional Complex. He was remanded just 6 days prior for multiple probation violations, according to the department. The ACLU of Alaska first reported that Leisk died by suicide and said, according to witnesses, that he lay for more than 3 hours before correctional staff began attempting life-saving measures. It was the second in-custody suicide this year. The civil rights group has called for more resources for mental health care and greater oversight and accountability from the Department of Corrections and protocols surrounding in-custody deaths and preventing more deaths. The Alaska Department of Public Safety confirmed Leisk's death was a suicide on Thursday. Alaska state troopers conduct investigations into all in-custody deaths. Also in April, two people died in custody that were medically expected deaths. DOC has reported 5 in-custody deaths so far this year. The recent deaths bring the tally to at least 70 deaths in custody of DOC jails and prisons since 2020, with at least 18 deaths reported as suicides. A lot has changed at the University of Alaska since President Trump's inauguration. After executive orders, the University of Alaska Board of Regents directed its university leadership to remove mentions of diversity, equity, and inclusion to protect its federal funding. But the Trump administration still froze or canceled millions of dollars. At the University of Alaska Southeast, Chancellor Aparna Palmer says she's trying to balance upholding the university's values with maintaining funding. Two of the campus's grants have been affected, but it has been able to restore or find other sources of funding for them. Palmer says she's focused on federal financial aid, which has not been touched yet.
My priority is to make sure that we do what it takes to preserve that federal student aid for our students. That would be a huge, huge percentage of students who would be affected.
She says about 40 to 50% of UAS students receive federal student aid. Palmer says students should continue applying for aid. On top of funding, UAS is keeping an eye on its international students' immigration status. Elsewhere in the state, 4 University of Alaska Anchorage students have had their visas revoked. But Palmer says U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers have not been on any University of Alaska Southeast campuses.
So far, none of their visas are being revoked, but we monitor the situation daily.
She says anyone who sees immigration enforcement officers on campus should report it immediately to the university so they can support and advocate for students. The Alaska Division of Insurance launched a tool this month to help Alaskans better understand the costs of common healthcare procedures. The new database will compare costs for Medicaid and Medicare, Premera and MOTA. MOTA and Premera are the two biggest private insurance providers in the state. Lori Wing-Heyer directs the State Division of Insurance. She hopes Alaskans use the database to recognize when they're being overcharged.
So if you're looking to have a procedure or a treatment or such, and you can see that the average cost is $200 on the database, but yet your quote that you had from your provider is $600. Well, somewhere, again, we're averaging things. There's a provider that's less than $600.
Alaska's healthcare costs are some of the highest in the world. She says creating the database is one of the first steps in a long journey to help bring down those costs. Wing-Heyer says reducing healthcare costs overall is a priority for Governor Dunleavy and his administration.
We are addressing it, but this is a problem that's going back 50 years, and it's going to take time to resolve it.
She says the database will also be a useful tool for legislators and policymakers. It may allow them to advocate for higher Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement rates for Alaska.
To me, the biggest advantage of this tool is going to be working with our counterparts in DC and elsewhere across the state, all payers, to say that if something costs $650, the provider should be reimbursed $650 as a minimum. There's got to be something that there's parity. For the cost.
Right now, Medicare and Medicaid are reimbursed for treatments and procedures at much lower rates than private insurance. And that means providers in Alaska shift those costs to other insurance plans. That's part of what makes healthcare so expensive in the state. Alaskans can access the health cost database through a link at insurance.alaska.gov. Well, some rural Alaskans are scrambling to get new IDs they'll need for federal air travel beginning next month. Offices of the state's Division of Motor Vehicles can issue compliant IDs, but Kotzebue's closed temporarily, although abruptly, in the run-up to the deadline. KOTZ's Desiree Hagen reports.
Kotzebue resident Michelle Kubelak has been looking forward to an upcoming trip to Hawaii. Over the last year, she's picked up extra jobs and worked more hours so that she can afford to take the entire family. It's not just a vacation. Her daughter is a graduating high school senior in Hawaii.
I would be so heartbroken if I'm not able to make it to my daughter's graduation.
Nearly a month ahead of the trip, Kubelak visited the Kotzebue DMV to get new Real ID compliant driver's licenses. There were about half a dozen people waiting. She says they were also there trying to get their real IDs.
And you have all these folks in the villages that are coming to town and, you know, hoping to walk in to get their IDs and having to go back to wherever they either flew or drove from.
When Kubelak says drove, she means by snow machine. No roads connect Kotzebue to the outlying villages. This time of year, snow machining and expensive flights are the only ways to get around. The office serves the community and a dozen neighboring villages. It's only open 3.5 hours each day, Monday through Friday. It's one employee splits her time, also working at the Alaska Department of Public Safety. When it was Kubelak's turn, she found out she didn't have all the required documents. When she rescheduled online, the DMV emailed her that it would be closed for the next few weeks because the employee had an unexpected life event. DMV officials say the office in Kotzebue will reopen on May 12th. Kubelak's family is scheduled to leave 2 days later.
So we leave to Hawaii on the 14th, and if the office is closed, basically my family won't be able to go watch my daughter graduate.
It's stressful.
I don't blame the only employee that we have at DMV. I know it's out of her control. It's more towards DMV office in the state that hoping and wishing that they could make it a priority by sending other people in place of the employee that's not at the office.
Many residents are also concerned they might be unable to fly to Anchorage for medical care. Lauren Whiteside is the DMV's Division Operations Manager.
Ensuring that DMV offices remain open and accessible to the public is a top priority for us. That being said, you know, smaller staffed offices like Kotzebue present unique challenges when unexpected circumstances arise.
Whiteside says the state has no intention of sending a relief worker to Kotzebue's DMV.
While we do have a mobile unit, it does take quite a bit of prep work ahead of time to bring the mobile unit to communities that have no access to DMV services.
The mobile DMV program so far has served 4 communities in the Bristol Bay region. Bristol Bay Native Corporation paid for the program. TSA issued a press release in January saying that it plans to begin phased enforcement starting May 7th, but has not provided additional information on what that means. The agency could not be reached for comment. Whiteside encouraged people with concerns to review the Alaska DMV website for additional information. In Kotzebue, I'm Desiree Hagen.
As Alaska faces a potentially severe wildfire season, miles of firebreak will be cleared in advance through one of Anchorage's largest areas of parkland. Stephanie Dufek with the Anchorage Fire Department's Wildland Division says the National Weather Service's wildfire forecast is clear.
The outlook for the wildfire season so far for 2025 has been consistently demonstrating that we are expecting a very busy and heavy wildfire season statewide.
With Anchorage's remaining snowpack low and trees already drying out, AFD is working on multiple wildfire mitigation projects around town. But Defec says the Stuckagin Heights neighborhood near Campbell Airstrip is uniquely concerning.
Campbell Airstrip Road is the only means residents of Stuckagin Heights have to evacuate. It is also the only way that responders can access a fire on that side of the hillside. So a shaded fuel break, which is what this is, will allow for safer access and egress.
Dufek says the project will see a 300-foot fire break cleared of spruce and hardwood stands, as well as ladder fuels along 3 miles of Campbell Airstrip Road.
We're going to remove all standing dead and down trees within that area. And we want to remove all the low-level fuels up to 8 feet from ground level. So basically just clearing that ground floor of the dead and down trees and then limbing up the trees to around 8 feet from that ground.
The fire department expects work to begin in the next few weeks and be completed within 6 months. The cleared trees will also become free firewood, with pickup locations and times to be announced. On Anchorage's Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, military officials will begin controlled burns tomorrow in training areas off the Glen Highway near Eagle River. Drivers in the area may see smoke plumes. Tips for protecting your home from wildfires are available online at wildfire.muni.org or forestry.alaska.gov/fire. The next time it snows in Anchorage, a motley cast of characters will take to the streets, including Edgar Allan Snow, Flurious George, and Betty Whiteout. Those are some of the newly christened graders and sidewalk clearers in the city's snow removal fleet. The names are the result of a citywide contest. Anchorage residents sent in nearly 200 submissions, and staff from the Municipal Snow Solutions team served as judges. It was a straight-up popularity contest. They voted for their favorites, and those with the most votes won. First place went to the Berminator. Top honors also go to Plowasaurus Rex, Luke Sidewalker, Blady Gaga, and Sweeping Beauty. But the plows won't have any recognizable identification, no Darth Grader paint job, no sign proudly announcing that they're Austin Plowers. A rep from the mayor's office said that the new policy to name the plows will make it easier to track the equipment online. In future wintry weather, residents will be able to watch the plows in nearly real time as they make their way through the city. The named graders and sidewalk sweepers will be assigned by seniority, so those who have been on staff the longest will be the most likely to get to sing Shake It Off as they drive Taylor Drift. The mayor's office said the contest was meant to raise awareness of what it takes to keep the city clear of snow in the winter and create joy while doing it. Skin sewing and beadwork are vital art forms in Thlinget culture passed down through generations. Rain Pavlik, a Thlinget artist from Yakutat, describes her handcrafted beadwork and skin-sewn garments as both contemporary and traditional. Alaska Public Media's Cadence Cedars talked with Pavlik when she was in Anchorage recently and has this story.
Rain Pavlik sits on a bed next to a large collection of her latest work.
It required a lot of tedious line work.
There's a pair of jeans with sealskin flare, a woman's suit made of deerskin and seal hide, and several more handmade pieces of clothing. Many of the pieces include ornate beading.
Sometimes I feel like beading a straight line is really hard.
She holds up a pair of hand-sewn moccasins.
Well, so this pair of moccasins is made with deer and moose skin.
She turns them over, revealing beadwork on the back.
By the end, I feel like I can see my progress in my beadwork.
The letters read Landback in an old English typeface.
Behind these moccasins is Landback, which is a message for the world we live in today to hopefully give indigenous peoples their land and sovereignty and right to stewardship. And
so Pavlik says she grew up in Yakutat, surrounded by artists.
That was just always part of our lives, is just doing art, is just part of the activities that we did.
She says she first learned from her mother how to sew items like pillowcases, but few members of her family practiced skin sewing on animal hides like moose and sea otter. So Pavlik learned from her aunt, Jenny Wheeler. She's a Thlinket artist who creates skin sewing pieces, beadwork, and spruce root weavings. Wheeler taught her how to make moccasins.
Making moccasins really was a way to connect to my family and my ancestors that way, just because I feel like it's so ingrained in our family stories.
Now Pavlik's community knows her for her beadwork and skin-sewn garments. She says her art blends tradition with modernity and is inspired by her Thlinket heritage. Pavlik says blending old materials with new designs gives her work meaning and momentum. She describes the process as almost spiritual.
Using the traditional materials and using it in a modern way feels like I'm honoring my ancestors, but I'm also modernizing some of the ideas that people have attached to traditional materials.
And she says sustainability is another way she connects to the tradition. She tries to only use materials from donations or thrift stores.
I also kind of felt like it's something that our ancestors would do, is they'd use what is near us and make things out of what is close by. And so I felt like that was a good way to honor them as well.
But keeping culture alive while making room for personal expression isn't always easy. Pavlik acknowledges the pressure facing Indigenous artists today. But Pavlik remains committed to exploring her own voice within the context of Tlingit art.
It just feels like something I'm supposed to do.
Pavlik says her art practice connects her to her ancestral knowledge and traditions. It's something her father noticed when she started skin sewing.
There was sort of an excitement there for my dad to see that, like, something that his mom knew how to do, his daughter knows now how to do as well.
And next, she says she wants to explore new ways to pass on her skills to the next generation. In Anchorage, I'm Kaden Cedars.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone, Alex Solomon, and Jamie Deep in Juneau, Avery Elfelt in Haines, Desiree Hagen in Kotzebue, and Rachel Cassandra, Chris Clint, Hannah Floor, and Kaden Cedars in Anchorage. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer tonight is Dave Waldron. Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.